from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a U.S. congressional letter to Iran stirs controversy.
It is completely legitimate for them to do this. Whether it's wise is another question.
Countering ISIS misconceptions of the West, motives for the Nemtsov murder, and riot police in Myanmar crack down on protesting students. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. An open letter to the leaders of Iran by 47 U.S. senators warns any nuclear agreement reached could be modified or revoked once President Obama leaves office in early 2017. Mr. Obama says the letter aligns the lawmakers to Iranian hardliners. But a prominent political scientist says while the letter is extraordinary and unusual, it is legitimate for the lawmakers to write it. VOA's Victor Beatty reports from Washington.
The open letter, authored by new Republican Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton and co-signed by 46 other Republican lawmakers, seeks to inform Iran's leaders that any nuclear agreement involving the United States could face constitutional hurdles. It states that while the president can negotiate international agreements, Congress plays a significant role in ratifying them. It says a so-called congressional executive agreement requires a majority vote in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, where a three-fifths majority of 100 senators is needed. The letter also warns that any agreement regarding Iran's nuclear weapons program that is not approved by the Congress will be viewed as nothing more than an executive agreement that could be revoked by a future president or modified by Congress. Asked about the letter Monday, President Obama says the U.S. lawmakers have aligned themselves with those in Iran who are opposed to the negotiations.
I think it's somewhat ironic to see some members of Congress wanting to make common cause with the hardliners in Iran. It's an unusual coalition. I think what we're going to focus on right now is actually seeing whether we can get a deal or not. And if we do, then we'll be able to make the case to the American people. And I'm confident we'll be able to implement it.
Sunday, Mr. Obama acknowledged gaps in the negotiating positions remain with less than a month to go before a self-imposed deadline to reach a framework agreement. He warned that he would walk away from the talks without proper transparency and verification Iran is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says the letter represents a partisan strategy to undermine the president's ability to conduct foreign policy and advance U.S. national security interests.
We have heard Republicans now for quite some time, including the principal author of this letter, make clear that their goal is to undermine these negotiations. That is not a position I am ascribing to Senator Cotton. That is a position that he has strongly advocated. He described it as a feature of his strategy, not a bug.
Earnest says the letter interferes with the effort to negotiate an agreement that seeks Tehran's commitment not to develop nuclear weapons. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the letter is designed to score political points and says Congress doesn't have the power to alter the terms of international arrangements negotiated by the executive. She says any agreement reached would not be a treaty requiring Senate ratification.
The Constitution assigns the authority to the executive to negotiate these deals with foreign partners. And so implying that Congress has a role that was implied in this letter is inaccurate. It's also a negotiation. It's an important to us for us to send this message to our partners around the world. That is with not just the United States and Iran, but with France, Germany, the United Kingdom, the European Union, China, and Russia.
Iran's foreign minister denounced the letter as having no legal value and dismissed it as mostly a propaganda ploy. He says the conduct of interstate relations is governed by international law, not by U.S. domestic law. He warns future revocation of any agreement would be a blatant violation of international law. Larry Sabato, a political science professor at the University of Virginia, says the letter by U.S. lawmakers to a foreign government is both extraordinary and unusual and represents an escalation of the political battle started last November when Republicans took control of both houses of Congress following elections.
They can't pass much because they really don't control Congress. They don't have sufficient numbers in either the House or the Senate to be able to overcome their factionalism or the Senate rules. But what they do have is the ability to send a letter like this and affect negotiations on a major treaty or executive agreement.
Sabato says the letter can be criticized on the basis of judgment, but it is not outside the boundaries of the Constitution.
In fact, because the legislature is a co-equal branch of government. It is completely legitimate for them to do this. Whether it's wise is another question.
Sabato says if any agreement reached with Iran is not submitted to the Senate as a treaty, it will be treated as an executive agreement, which can be revoked by a succeeding president. He says no doubt Iran's leaders are making that part of their calculus. Sabato says if President Obama wishes any nuclear agreement with Tehran to last, he would have to submit it to the Senate for ratification. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The militant group calling itself the Islamic State, or ISIS, has proven adept at using 21st century media to radicalize young people. The key to their strategy is the contention that the West in general, and the United States in particular, are at war with Islam. They promote a narrative that claims Western interference is largely responsible for the historic grievances of the Islamic world. Experts on shaping public opinion say refuting the ISIS message is no easy task because the narrative feeds into long-held beliefs in the Middle East. Adil Iskandar of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada, spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy about various strategies for helping impressionable youth to understand the falsehoods in the ISIS message.
Professor Iskandar, testifying on Capitol Hill, National Intelligence Director James Clapper told members of Congress that something needs to be done to counter the Islamic State's extensive use of social media to lure young people. As an expert of media, how could the United States counter Islamic State propaganda through the social media?
It's very difficult to counter Islamic States and ISIS's approach to social media because it's working on a series of different propositions. The first being that the United States is, or the perception that the United States is, an imperial power that has undermined stability in the region, that it played a significant role in the destabilization of Iraq and various other countries in the Middle East and the Muslim world at large. So the first step is to actually counter that message by demonstrating that the United States is not waging a war against Islam. It is not taking an invasive sort of, it doesn't have an imperial ambition in the region, and that it doesn't support authoritarian governments in the Middle East and in the Muslim world. So that's one dimension. The second dimension is to challenge the view that that ISIS produces, that presumes that all Muslims are one and the same, that they have a single perception of their own theology, that they have a single perception of their adversaries, and are in solidarity with their interpretation of the faith. So while the United States cannot create sort of a discourse that is critical of ISIS's interpretation of Islam, but it can nevertheless support the pre-existing regional efforts to challenge extremist discourse. And I think thirdly is to basically the conflict itself needs to be focused and grounded largely in a confrontation by Muslims against the Islamic State, rather than the United States, which is perceived as a Judeo-Christian society or Western civilization by ISIS. And so the key here is to avoid falling into the trap that this is basically the West versus the East, the Muslim world versus the Judeo-Christian world, and all of these sort of civilizational struggles. What ISIS has been focused on is basically pushing this agenda that it's us versus them, and you have to choose what your interpretation of the world might be. And so to challenge the us versus them discourse is the first and most important step that the United States should and urgently needs to take when confronting much of this propaganda coming out of ISIS.
But Islamic scholars already refuted such claims, but still more volunteers are joining ISIS. What's missing in the message by Islamic scholars to the young people?
Well, I think it's a combination of these things. On one part, we have to realize that in the Muslim world, authority doesn't necessarily function quite the same way that let's say the papacy or Christian society might be. There are, of course, clerics and leaders and ayatollahs and al-Azhar and authorities that are responsible for jurisprudence and putting out edicts on specific issues. But abiding and conforming to those is contingent on individual choice. And so to a large extent, many of the institutions of religious interpretation that critique ISIS are not necessarily as popular as what as one might assume. ISIS is very quick to dismiss them on the grounds that they are either not conforming to sort of this their archaic view of Islamic interpretation, but more importantly, that they are also perceived as complicit with the United States and imperial power and Western domination of the region. When it comes out of clerics and associations, Muslim associations in the United States and Western Europe, they are perceived as having been basically co-opted by Western society or Western sort of sensibilities and ideologies and worldviews. So this is a very, very difficult process. It has to be more about grassroots activity than it is about authorities dismissing or disengaging. It has to do with revisiting some of the curricula, some of the teaching instruments, some of the scriptures themselves to see how are these interpretations being contorted and misused in such an active way. It's not just about condemnation, but more about the difficult work of figuring out where things went wrong in terms of interpretation that would lead to such strict and diabolical interpretation.
Adil Iskander of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. Several people have been charged in the February 27th shooting death of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, the staunch foe of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Nemtsov was shot four times in the back as he walked across a bridge with his girlfriend in sight of the Kremlin. VOA's Andre Dineshnera asked Bob Legvold from Columbia University who the suspects are.
They appear to be Chechens. Some of them have been in Moscow for some time, so not necessarily recently in Chechnya, at least as residents, but Chechens.
Do we know anything about a motive for Mr. Nemtsov's killing?
If this trail is the right trail, then it leads in one of two directions. I'm not sure that this is necessarily the right trail. The one would be, in the most simplistic interpretation, because the leader in Chechnya, Kadyrov, who knows at least some of these people, and at least he's confessed that he knows some of these people, one of whom evidently was on his police force, claimed that one of the two had become radicalized in Islam and had been deeply offended by what happened in Paris around the magazine, Charlie Hebdo. And Nemtsov is seen as, first of all, very critical of those that had attacked Charlie Hebdo and have been very critical of Islamist violence. So it seems to me a little bit far-fetched, but one explanation would be that these were individuals who were acting the way in which the same kind did what they did in Paris. The more ominous explanation would be that it leads back to Kadyrov himself, and the reason that he might have organized it is that he has allied himself quite publicly with Putin on the Ukrainian issue, Maidan, and the like. He evidently had something to do with this demonstration of younger Chechens in Moscow that demonstrated against critics of the Ukrainian war or supporters of Ukraine and Maidan, and that included Nemtsov. So it conceivably, as I say, it leads back to Kadyrov himself. There have always been strong suspicions that Kadyrov was behind the assassination, the murder of Anna Politkovskaya, and if that is true, it never traced to him. If that is true, then he's certainly capable of doing this kind of thing.
And he is capable of doing it without direct orders from the Kremlin.
He wouldn't need direct orders from the Kremlin for that. I think it's unlikely that there wouldn't have been a wink and a nod involved if he's the guy behind it. Although even that even that may not have been necessary. He may have felt that he could pull this kind of thing off himself. I don't know. But as I say, these are all of these affairs, whether it's Politkovskaya or Litvinenko or the other three or four cases like that, they never seem to lead to the organizer. They may end up arresting some of the people who pulled the triggers, but you never quite know who's behind it. And I think there is the risk of that in this case. Even if it is Kadyrov who did it, either on his own or with some auspices from people at the center, or maybe particularly if that's the case, it's unlikely to be traced to him. I don't think Putin or government agencies under Putin would go after Kadyrov.
And there, as you say, a history of unsolved murders.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the case of Politkovskaya, the people who were eventually arrested, tried, and convicted and sentenced rather resemble, from the North Caucasus, rather resemble the people that have been arrested in this case. So who knows? But you started with the question of what might be the motive if, as I said, these are identified as Chechens. And as I say, it could either be if they were radicalized Muslims who were targeting Nemtsov because of the larger issues underway in Europe. It's conceivable it happened in France, it happens elsewhere, but in the Russian context, I would assume there's a bigger fish behind it.
Bob Legvold from Columbia University. Riot police in Myanmar today attacked student protesters, ending their attempt, at least for now, to march to Yangon to protest education legislation. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Police wielding batons at Letpadon dispersed about 200 protesters, primarily students and sympathetic monks. Some of the student leaders have been detained, putting a halt to the nearly one-week standoff. Protest leader Tiha Win Tin, speaking to VOA, said at least 32 people in total have been arrested. He said some of the students were hit with batons and bricks and were bleeding from their heads. A reporter on scene for the Democratic Voice of Burma says Buddhist monks were also among those arrested. For days, the demonstrators had been blocked behind wood and barbed wire barriers erected by police. Earlier Tuesday, negotiations had been underway to allow the students to continue their march 140 kilometers north of Yangon. But European Press Photo Agency staff photographer Nian Chan Nyang, who was on the scene, says the agreement fell apart.
Student Buddhists trying to break through the police line and police stand against the student Buddhists. So suddenly, someone threw the water bottle or something, then the violence started.
Police were also seen destroying the loudspeaker truck of the protest group and attacking an ambulance in which some protesters took refuge. The EPA photographer says journalists initially were unhindered, but then also became targets of the police.
They also tried to attack the journalists, and they shouted at us that journalists also get out. You cannot stay here. They tried to use their rubber stick to hit the journalists, so we also have to run away from there.
University students in Myanmar, also known as Burma, have been conducting on-and-off protests for months against an education bill adopted last year. They say it stifles academic freedom. The students also want the government to spend more money on education and allow them to have unions for students and faculty. Until now, the protests had been relatively free of violence, but that began to change last Thursday when police, backed by deputized civilians wearing red armbands, broke up a pro-student rally in downtown Yangon. Demonstrators said police used batons against them and detained others who were later released. There are growing fears that authorities in Myanmar could choose to return to tougher actions against not only student demonstrators, but also factory workers who have been on strike seeking higher wages. Military leaders in 1988 brutally suppressed protests, although a reformist government took over in 2011, ending nearly a half century of military rule. The army still plays a powerful role in the government. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 10th, 241 BC, the first of three conflicts between Rome and Carthage was decided in a naval battle off the west coast of Sicily. The Roman fleet scored a victory, leading to a Carthaginian surrender in the first of the so-called Punic Wars. On this date in 1804, the American flag was raised on day two of the Three Flags ceremony in St. Louis. This happened after the French and Spanish flags had been lowered. The ceremony marked the turning over of the Louisiana Purchase, more than 2 million square kilometers of territory, to the United States. In 1831, the French Foreign Legion was created. The Legion was an all-volunteer force that once attracted mostly foreigners, troublemakers, and outcasts. Commanded by French officers, the Legion has seen combat in regional and world wars. In 1848, the U.S. Senate ratified the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, ending the three-year war between the United States and Mexico. With the defeat of its army and the fall of its capital, Mexico ceded territory, now covering some or all of the U.S. states of Arizona, New Mexico, California, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. In 1906, Europe's worst mining accident occurred in northern France. A coal dust explosion took the lives of more than 1,000 men. On this day in 1910, slavery was officially abolished in China. On this day in 1913, abolitionist Harriet Tubman died. Over the course of 10 years, Tubman, a runaway slave, would lead hundreds of other slaves to freedom along the so-called Underground Railroad, a secret network of safe houses. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Violent extremism represents one of the most serious challenges to the global community today. Violent extremists seek to exploit our cultural, economic, and religious differences to sow suspicion and mistrust, as well as to recruit and radicalize. But violent extremism is a threat that recognizes no national borders, nor does it choose its victims based on nationality, gender, age, ethnicity, or religion. And because we are all threatened, said Secretary of State John Kerry, we must not accept the extremist narrative that our differences are more significant than our common commitment to ending violent extremism. Violent extremism has claimed lives in every corner of the globe, and Muslim lives most of all. Each of us is threatened, regardless of ethnicity, faith, or homeland. We must demonstrate to the terrorists that rather than divide us, their tactics unite us and strengthen our resolve, said Secretary Kerry.
Whatever one's individual experience might be, there are no grounds of history, religion, ideology, psychology, politics, or economic disadvantage, or personal ambition that will ever justify the killing of children, the kidnapping or rape of teenage girls, or the slaughter of unarmed civilians. These atrocities cannot be rationalized. They cannot be excused.
In late February, President Barack Obama hosted representatives from local and national governments, civil society, and the private sector around the world for a summit in Washington, D.C. Together, these stakeholders discussed not only current violent extremist threats, including ISIL, but also ways to prevent the emergence of violent extremism by addressing its underlying drivers. As Secretary Kerry stressed, we must strengthen the role of civil society, in particular women, youth, and victims, and to ensure that civil society has a space to be able to operate. We need to identify and amplify credible voices, expanding religious and other education that promotes tolerance and peace and respect for all religions. We need to address the social, economic, and political marginalization that is part of this challenge. At the summit's conclusion, delegates pledged to work on a common action agenda that will guide the global community in preventing violent extremism. Participants recognize that only together through a multi-stakeholder approach, not simply through military engagement and not simply through governments, can the international community address this long-term challenge. We are in this for the long haul. We can send a clear signal to the next generation that its future will not be defined by the agenda of the terrorists and the violent ideology that sustains them. We will not cower, and we will prevail by working together, said Secretary Kerry. Our collective security depends on our collective response.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.